Hey there, welcome to Board Game Hot Takes. My name's Tim.
This is Chris.
This is Adam.
And today we're going to be giving our hot take review on the game we just finished playing, Age of Innovation. But before we do, I've got a poll question for you all. I asked a question on social media, on our Blue Sky account and our Facebook group. If you have a regular gaming group, is your partner or spouse a part of that group, or is it your own thing? So the options I gave, this question doesn't apply to me, and we got 11% answered that. No, it's my own thing was 63%, and yes, we're both in the same group, 26% answered that way. How'd you guys answer this question?
Wait, technically, Tim, is it your own thing or your own thang?
Thang.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was clear on that.
Thanks for the clarification, Chris. The way I didn't answer this one because I didn't know how to answer it. To have a gaming group, right, that means at least two people. So I guess my partner, Sarah, is my primary gaming group. I don't think it counts if it's just one and you're playing games three-handed. You can't have three of me in a group. So that didn't work.
I think then the question would not have applied to you if that was your only situation.
Or randos from across the world that play Azul on Board Game Arena. That's also my gaming group. I recognize some of the names now. I play so much. I'm like, oh, this guy from Denmark, he's pretty good.
Well, the reason I asked this question was because I've got a few great game groups, right? I mean, I play with you guys, but let's just talk about in-person game groups for a second. But I'm trying to do like a regular weekly group Thursday night at my house. I've been having a consistent, you know, 2 to 5 people showing up. And my wife was home last week. A lot of the time she's out at networking events or traveling for work or whatever. But last week she happened to be home and I was finishing up the event and I was like, hey, you know, you could have joined us. And so it occurred to me that I was like, why isn't she part of that group? And she said, no, I didn't want to join you. I don't want to learn some stupid new game and hang out with your dumb friends. No, she didn't actually say that. Well, but I think yes, that was the general sentiment that she had. So, you know, she chose not to, or she would choose not to, but it wasn't like she was excluded from it. So I was just thinking about that a little bit. Now, we do have a gaming group, which my wife actually puts together about once a month. We get together with 5 or 6 people and we play games. It's like, you know, a little bit lighter games, but not significantly. Like we're playing good midweight games with that group. So she's part of that group. So she's definitely there. But then, you know, my wife, she loves tennis and she plays tennis 3 or 4 times a week with some friends, with different people. And sometimes her and I play tennis too, but she plays it a lot more. She's much more passionate about it. She wants to get out more frequently. She wants to do it with, you know, more competitive people. And so I think gaming is kind of like that with us, right? She likes to play games. In fact, she just asked to play Everdell with me last night. We played a game, but she's not as invested in this hobby. She doesn't want to be playing every week, several games late into the night, learning new games every week and stuff like that. So I think, you know, if I was going to answer what my question really intended, I would say it's my own thing, but it's kind of hard to answer that way. It's kind of a mix.
And tennis is a game. Does that count?
It is, but I said board. Well, okay. Ha. Yeah. I said regular game. I meant, yeah. All right. Chris,
flood,
you got me.
Flood,
got me
there. Hole. No, my answer is more or less the same as yours, Tim. My wife is not strictly a member of my in-person gaming group, but not because she's not, you know, game, so to speak. She actually has asked to join in, but if we have it at our house. Now, see, the problem with that is that almost all the people who are in this game group that I play here in Portland are all up in like downtown, the downtown area of Portland, which is, you know, it's a half an hour drive from where I live, which is kind of out in the country. And so she always says, well, invite them here. I'd love to play a game with you guys. But the reality is I don't think people want to drive down to where I live. So it's usually me and the one other guy who live down this way commuting up to where the larger group is. But it's actually a great group for this kind of a thing because there's multiple spouses who pop in and out of the group, you know, show up for a game night now and then on top of the regulars. So it's very welcoming, a great opportunity for, you know, a spouse to join in. And so hopefully, you know, sometime not too far in the future, my wife will get a chance to play with the group that I play with if I can ever convince anybody to drive out to the boonies.
Yeah, both of your partners are great gaming people too, like Sarah and Rachel both. I mean, I played with both of them and they're cutthroat, they're smart, you know, they're the people to beat at the table typically when they're sitting there playing. So it's cool. I mean, you know, my wife's the same way. Like is very competitive with me when we're playing games. But it's just, I think, just a different level of enthusiasm where she wouldn't be initiating a weekly game night, you know, and trying to build a friend group around it and stuff like that. Well, here's how some of the people answered on our Facebook group. So Joanna Kloss said, I barely have a group, but when we get together, my husband plays too. I am interested in getting a regular gaming group, which he may not participate in just because he doesn't like games as much as I do. So similar to what we all answered here. Dan Montes said, I will say my gaming group is my own thing. However, she does participate when we bring the game night to our house. We have a 4 and 7 year old. So being an amazing wife, she watches the kids so I can game with my friends one night a week. She used to be part of the group pre-kids. TLDR, if I had a babysitter, my wife would be part of the group. Yeah, I, you know, there's some element to that as well. I mean, that's kind of like the trade-off. My wife goes away to tennis when I'm home with the kid, taking care of other responsibilities. I'm doing my things when she's, you know, it's, that's kind of what our relationship is like that as well. It's like that compromise and trading places. And, you know, so everyone can't be everywhere all the time. Emily Boudreau said, my husband does not like games. He will indulge me on some games, but I feel bad getting him to play when he doesn't enjoy it. His one game he likes is spades, but we rarely have four players. We have done two-player spades, but that falls more into the indulge category. He hates games where the rules don't stay the same or have exceptions or when it takes too long for turns to come back around. Ah, well, Emily, that is sad, but that is our lot in life sometimes. And then over on Blue Sky, Alan Fisher said, I met my wife through an RPG, so I'd be in the doghouse if I didn't include her. Jason said, I'm very fortunate. My wife is my main game partner. We have multiple groups of friends that we game with, and I have another couple of groups that she doesn't participate in. Whiskey, wine, and rule books with her. 3,475 games together and counting. It's the best.
Wow.
That's awesome, Jason. That's awesome. That's so cool that you got a wonderful gaming partner right at home with you. Sarah Reed said, when I first started my weekly iGame night, it was just me with my friends, as Will would play video games with a friend. But when his friends couldn't come over as often, Will joined my iGame night. Now we have two regular iGame nights that we organize with different friends. I assume when she says iGame nights, they're talking about like digital gaming, kind of like what we're doing. I think that's what they mean there.
That's what I assume you said that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know.
Yeah. In any case, so just this is a little tidbit. So Sarah is she's a game designer and runs a gaming channel called Gaming with Two that she does with her husband, or a partner. I'm not sure what Will is, but she just recently, I was on social media and she posted that she was actually the creator of the 10x10 challenge. Like it was something that she came up with like 10, 12 years ago, posted on social media, and it kind of took off. And now it's like a well-known thing in the hobby. So well done, Sarah. That's very cool that you brought something that cool to the hobby.
And just in case, just to make sure we're talking about the same 10x10 challenges, you play 10 different games 10 times over the course of a year. Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And now there's all kinds of like, you can do a 5x5 challenge or a, you know, 3x3 challenge or whatever, or a 10x20 challenge or whatever, you know, you need. But, you know, that was kind of the initial intent with it. There's even like, you can buy like a little board for tracking your 10x10 challenge over the course of the year. So it's a whole hobby thing at this point. Have you guys ever thought about doing a 10x10 challenge? Kind of off on a tangent here.
I don't want to lose at something again, so I have not decided to do a 10x10 challenge.
I'm working on a 1x1 challenge. Yeah. Not quite there yet.
Yeah, that's cool. I think I stopped tracking my plays about 6 months ago. And I think when I would look, I was always hitting 10x10 in a year because there's just some games that some of my, like, especially like my wife loves to play over and over again, or a couple of groups. So I think 10x10 is pretty easy for me. But if I was picking very specific games that I just wanted to get on there, that might be a little harder. But in any case, it's fun activity.
Well, in BGA, I mean, if you factor BGA games into that, you could get a 10x10 week.
That's right. All right. Well, that will wrap up that poll conversation. Let's jump into a description of Age of Innovation. Age of Innovation is a sequel of sorts to Terra Mystica. It uses most of the same mechanisms, although several of them are refined or enhanced to allow for more variability. And it's set in the same world, but later chronologically, in what might be considered the renaissance of this fantasy world. Thematically, there's a focus on building cities, gaining knowledge and scholars, and developing technological innovations. From your starting location on the board, your unique fantasy race with its unique special abilities is going to be trying to spread out by placing additional buildings. But in order to do so, you'll have to terraform the terrain types that don't match your faction's preferred terrain so that it becomes inhabitable for your civilization and likely uninhabitable by your opponents. So make sure to beat them to the juiciest spots on the board. You'll do this and several other types of actions like upgrading your capabilities, upgrading your buildings, developing innovations, building cities out of groups of connected buildings, and improving scientific disciplines in a turn-based round structure, and usually by spending some combination of your resources. Once every player has used up all their resources and passed in a round, players will get a round-specific point bonus based on the actions they've done, and then will take resources for the next round based on the income they've developed in their civilization. After six rounds, players will score additional points based on largest sets of connected buildings and how high they are on the science tracks. The player with the most points is the winner. Age of Innovations was designed by Helgi Ostertag and published in North America by Capstone Games. So with that said, let's jump into the gameplay and mechanisms of Age of Innovations. And I think we'd be remiss to not mention that this is a game that's very similar to one of our favorites, Gaia Project, as well. So I think it's going to be very hard for us not to make some regular comparisons to what we liked in this or didn't like in it compared to Gaia Project. But in any case, Adam, what do you think? Gameplay and mechanisms.
Well, first thing I thought, well, that was a great rules description, Tim. Nicely done.
Yeah.
That's the way to get me to do it more.
That was wonderful.
Makes me want to play this game.
So what did I like here? What's the mechanism that stood out? I think the just the building and get the buildings out and the way the terraforming works, I thought was pretty cool. So I'm not sure how Terra Mystica works. I've actually never played Terra Mystica. But like you said, in Gaia Project, you have to pay some extra. Typically, you have to pay some extra ore in order to build a mine on a different planet, or you can go up on this tech track that helps you colonize other planets. Here, it's shovels. You got to get the construction crew together to go grade this land and make it so you can build your type of buildings on this land. So you're paying in extra shovels, which could be extra tools in this game, which is ore in Gaia Project, more or less. But I liked how that worked. You have your kind of central terrain, and then you have to pay an extra shovel for the more you go away from your main terrain. I thought that's a nice, simple way of displaying the information and presenting it and paying for it. Easy to manage, easy to understand, a lot more comprehensible to me than the way they do that in Gaia Project. Another side note with that is kind of the two-step phases of doing that. You can terraform that land and have this chunk of land there, and you might not even have a building on it, and your opponent could theoretically terraform it back to their preferred type of land. So I thought that little dynamic was a nice little twist and something that Gaia Project doesn't have.
Yeah, for a mechanism that is so close to Gaia Project, it did feel in some ways, I think it felt less punishing, and maybe that was kind of the whole game was like that. It always felt like resources were just a little bit easier to get to. Yeah. We mentioned it, you know, while we were playing about how power seemed a little bit more accessible, but for some reason, everything felt just a little bit less just tight in this game. And I think Gaia Project, as much as I love it, is probably just a tad tight, right? I mean, to the extent at some point where it feels like, God, I can't do anything. And I felt like this opened things up a little bit where you just had a bit more to do. So I like that a lot. The other thing, though, that I want to mention, aside from how the terraforming feels a little different, but the movement and the, you know, kind of the building adjacency, the way that worked, it's not that it was necessarily easier or any more interesting, but I think it did simplify it a little bit. Like there was a little bit less, I think just rules overhead with movement rules that you have to deal with in Gaia Project. And that also made the city, you know, which compares to the Federations, but the city adjacency rules were a little simpler. So somehow it managed to take almost the same exact rules and just slightly streamline them in a way that was still really fun to play around. So yeah, just a couple things there about things that are pretty comparable to Gaia Project.
Yeah, at risk of being repetitive, I do want to kind of go back and amplify something that Adam already mentioned, just because I thought it was really, really significant to me. And that was, you know, you'd mentioned, Adam, about how you could terraform an area without actually building on it. And what was interesting about that was that you could terraform it to any degree. So you could use one shovel and move it, you know, one level, or two shovels to move it two levels. And so in Gaia Project, it's not so much that you're terraforming, like changing that planet. It's really about how much resources do I have to spend in order to have permission to build onto this planet. But you're not really changing the planet in reality. In Age of Innovation, you're actually flipping another tile on top of the existing terrain and changing that terrain. And so you may or may not end up building on it, and you don't have to terraform it all the way to be usable by you. So if, for example, in one turn, if you had enough resources to be able to terraform it one step, you might terraform it one step and then terraform it another step another time. And you also mentioned something that you mentioned it offhandedly, but it was actually a really big thing to me, was the ability for someone else to come in if you haven't built on a space and then snatch it out from under you by terraforming it back to whatever it is that they want it to be. And there was a number of times in this game where, unlike Gaia Project, I was kind of afraid to terraform in an area because then I was afraid that someone else was going to do that and I'd lose the opportunity to put something on that space. And there are certain situations where you might want to terraform and not build something there, because there's also these neutral buildings, which you don't have in Gaia Project. And the neutral buildings are ones that can be used to build a city, but they don't give you other benefits. But generally, you have to have a terraformed area ready to put those buildings onto, and then you have to wait till the next turn to put the building there. So it was a really interesting cat and mouse. I mean, how to deal with that. And I found that to be one of the most interesting differences between this and Gaia Project. And it was really impactful.
Yeah, the neutral buildings was a whole new concept for me in this game. And I thought that was pretty fun. Like, when to use those, what to do with them, how to use them. That was a whole new puzzle for me coming from Gaia Project, which I thought was great. One thing that's not here, which I'm really happy about, I mentioned this during the course of play, there's none of the Gaia former track. You don't have those annoying things from, one of the most annoying things for me from Gaia Project is these little Gaia formers you got to put out on a purple planet and you wait a turn and then you pull them back and you got to spend time and resources getting these things. You don't have any of that here. It's just build or don't build or terraform or don't terraform. So I thought that was a nice little nuance also.
What you do have here is something that Gaia Project already did well, which was a ton of variability, both variability in setup, variability in different, you know, the way the factions play. And it like escalated drastically here in a couple ways. I'll mention these really quickly. So first of all, in Gaia Project, right, you pick or draft or whatever, you get a faction at the beginning and it matches up with a color of terrain that you're dealing with. In this one, the terrain is unmatched from the player abilities. So those can be completely variable. And the way that the setup was the first time we played, I think there's a couple options you can do. But what we did is, like, it randomly set up one terrain type with one faction with a starting bonus tile. And then you would go around and draft those. And that was super fun. And you know that's going to mix it up, because, like, the next time the swamps are going to be mixed up with the, you know, architects or whatever, and they're going to interact in a way that the previous faction mix didn't. So I like that. The next was that, you know, in Gaia Project, as you upgrade to that big building, I forget what it's called, but in this one it was the palace. So essentially, if you upgrade the smallest building up to like a trading house, and then the trading house up to a palace, in the past those were linked. You had a special ability with that building that was linked to the faction that you picked. In this one, when you upgrade to the palace, you pick from a display of random available options that are out there, and that's going to vary every game what's available and who picks them first. So that was super fun. And then you have the technology tiles, which are pretty similar to Gaia Project, but they have this innovation tiles, I think they're called, but these special ones that you could spend books for that would give you additional special powers or one-time scoring benefits. So, and all of these things are going to be just a little bit variable based on player count, based on, you know, what comes up in that setup in the round. There is so much to explore. I think the next time I played this, the game would play out completely different. My strategy would go a completely different way just because of how those things set up. So, you know, again, something that Gaia Project already did well, I think Age of Innovation improves in almost every way there.
I'm going to agree with that in part and disagree with that in part. I thought that it was a little bit overly complicated to me. And maybe this was a combination of two things. For one, there were actually three different areas that sort of equated to technology in this game to me. And one of them was there was a bunch. One of them was I forget what it was called. It was the academic tracks, where you could send your scholars and move up a track, which gave you endgame points. And it also gave you certain benefits at certain places. As you move up this track, you got these income benefits. Then there were the competency tiles, which are the ones that you get when you end up building one of your schools. And then there was the innovation tile. So there's a lot of these different tiles that did different things. And this is something that comes with a first play, but I found myself spending a lot of time going back and forth between these tiles because there's a bunch of them. There must have been a couple dozen of them out there that all did different things with pretty complex iconography on them. At least some of them did. Some were pretty basic. You know, there was income tiles that gave you a tool or something like that. But there was a bunch that were pretty complicated. And I remember at one point in the game, Adam was looking at one and I read the paragraph worth of explanation to him. And it was like a goofy joke. I mean, how complicated it was trying to understand what that tile did. I wish it was a little bit more simple, and I wish that some of the tiles felt a little more impactful. Some of them felt very minor for something that was, you know, that difficult to get. That's a relatively minor complaint. Overall, I thought it was an interesting element of the game. I actually think this is one where Gaia Project did it a little bit better, but there's a lot less variability in Gaia Project, which I think would be the downside of that.
Yeah, so we're talking about the kind of the tech tracks here and the benefits from, well, you're right, Chris, there's the academic track. So in Gaia Project, you have the tech track, and that's one of the biggest differences, I think, the way the tech track is. There's only four tracks here compared to six in Gaia Project, and you get a tech in, or you build an academy or a university here, a school here, and that gets you in Gaia Project. It moves you up the research track, and maybe you get another tech from there, and you get some ongoing benefits or one-time benefits. Here, it's a little bit different. When you build your university here, you do get this. It could be a tech. It could be a one-time thing. A lot more variability there. And then to go up these tracks, it's a whole different process. From you kind of pick which tech you want there, and that sends you up these little tracks that give you a lot less benefit than they do, at least to me, it seems like a lot less benefit as you're working your way up than the tracks do in Gaia Project. So that, to me, that's one of the biggest differences in the two games, other than these other subtle differences that we're talking about. So a lot different kind of a puzzle, I think, is what Chris is alluding to. Is it better or not? I don't know. It's just different. And I think it was pretty enjoyable the way they did it here. What's your preference going to be? I don't know.
The tech tracks, how they vary from Age of Innovation between Gaia Project is unique. And I didn't think I was going to like it because it seems like you're just moving up these tracks and there's not a whole lot that's happening with them. But the one thing that I thought was really cool is that in this one, at the end of each round, you know, you already have like a round scoring marker that's similar to Gaia Project. But at the end of each round, you're also going to get an extra bonus depending on where you are on a specific track. And it multiplies by how high you are on that track. So for me, that was really fun. The other reason why I thought it was fun in this game is it was a lot easier to move up those tracks than it is in Gaia Project. You know, Gaia Project's like you're going to move up a few times, right? Like only when you're getting a technology, only when you do a couple specific things can you move up those tracks. In this one, you were just moving up them all the time. And again, it was another place where the economy here felt a little bit less tight and you just got to do more stuff. That's almost all positive for me. There's one situation where it wasn't. I'll talk about that in my final thoughts. But yeah, I thought the tech tracks were different, not necessarily way better, but I did enjoy them and I think more than I expected to. So the one other thing I wanted to mention here was I guess I said I was going to talk about my final thoughts, but it's my one negative. And that is that, you know, last week we talked about climax in board games. And this game, I felt like the final round was the weakest round. And this may have been a first play. It may have been because we weren't playing great. But the last round, it felt like we were just going around taking a bunch of tiny little actions to try to use up our resources and get whatever few little points we could get. Versus the rounds before it, as we'd start to get, you know, like you had these big turns where, oh, I just built the city. Okay, now I can, you know, build a big academy. Now I can get this big innovation tile, turn in these books for an innovation tile. And the last round of the game here, it felt like we were just wasting a lot of, wasting time, wasting turns just to use up these last resources. And so that kind of like a game that I was so excited and having so much fun with the whole time, that last, you know, half of the last round was, I was just a little duller and like nothing big was happening, nothing too exciting. Again, that might change on a second play, but that felt weaker than it, we're in Gaia Project. You're trying to get that last resource to make that one big federation. And we just weren't doing that in this last round here. So maybe that was our fault, but something I noticed.
That's so funny because my reaction was exactly the opposite. I actually, I found the climax of Age of Innovation to be more exciting than the climax of Gaia Project. And I think for me, that's because of the tightness of the economy in Gaia Project. Generally, what happens there is not that I'm trying to get the last resource to get that big federation. It's just like I'm petering out and being like, okay, everybody else has still got 10 things to do, and I'm floundering around trying to figure out anything, and then I'm passing five turns before anybody else did. I think in Age of Innovation, I actually thought there's a lot more opportunities to get things done, so maybe I could do something that would get me a point or two here or a point or two there. I actually like that a lot. But that also brings me back to one other point that I wanted to talk about that we didn't get into, but somebody raised over the course of the game, and that was the benefits that you could get from power. And for those who have played Terra Mystica or Gaia Project, power is very important. And power, by in this game, we mean these little purple tokens that you cycle between three bins. And there's a sort of a starting bin where you can't do anything and you have to cycle all your power one piece at a time to the second bin. And then once you get to the third bin, then you can actually spend it to do things. And in Gaia Project, it can, like everything in Gaia Project, it can feel really, really tight, and there's limited things that you can do with your power unless you're really good at manipulating it. I felt like in Age of Innovation, the power flowed so much, there was almost always one little thing, one extra thing you could do that if you needed something, power was a good way to get it. And there were enough different things you could do with that power, many more opportunities to use power than you had in Gaia Project. And I thought that was great. I really enjoyed that. I'm not a super big fan of ultra tight economy games. And I thought that loosened the economy up enough that I found that part of it more enjoyable than Gaia Project.
A couple of interesting notes here I want to talk about. I like the difference in perspective on the climax of this game. I'm kind of two minds. Yeah, we were taking little nitpicky turns at the end, throwing a resource here, but it was fun to watch those scores up and up and up. And ooh, I'm in the lead for a second or two. Now Tim's in the lead. Now Chris is in the lead. How's this all going to shake down? Oh, Chris just passed me on the track. So this ties in what we're going to talk about next week is the conclusion of the game. So in Gaia Project, at the end of the game, maybe there's still 70, 80 points that you're going to add up. So it's not necessarily clear unless you're a nerd like me and you're like, oh, I can see Tim is going to get 66 points at the end of the game. Here, there's only, it's really clear what you're going to score for. Everybody at the top of the track is going to get some points. Second place, getting third points, getting some points. And then you're looking at the longest consecutive building, longest road, basically, from Catan. Chris said not to make that analogy, but it's kind of like a longest road situation. So you get in-game points for that and in-game points for highest on these tech tracks. So it's really clear, really easy to see what's going to happen there. A quick conclusion in this game as compared to a lengthier add up all these different points, look at all the tech tracks, do this, do that, this other thing, and add up all your in-game points. So I don't know. I'm still kind of on the fence. You know, there's just different ways to do it. I do like the lesser amount of in-game points here than there are in Gaia Project. I think that's nice, unless you're used to what's going down in a game with a big chunk of in-game points that aren't tallied ahead of time. So some interesting perspectives.
Yeah. The last thing about the points is Gaia Project's different in that there's usually two unique end-game scoring conditions that you're fighting for there versus this one. It's one that's always the same. This was nice this time that the conclusion came easy. It was a couple quick scoring decisions. It was fun to see who got the most points on those tracks as he moved up. But would it get tiring in future games? Would that be something that everybody pushes for? I don't know. This first game, it was fun for me. It may not stay as interesting in future games, but that is one area where Age of Innovation lacks the variability that Gaia Project does.
And that actually reminds me of one last thing I'll mention before we jump into the production and theme. But the end of round scoring, which you have in both of these games, is slightly different in that Age of Innovation also has an end of round benefit that you can get. So you have one piece that gives you scoring that happens over the course of the round. So if you build a certain type of building, you get points. But The other one Tim had mentioned earlier was that based on where you were on a particular academic track, you would also get some benefits. So if you, for every three steps you were up on the, you know, a particular track, you might get a tool, or you might get a book, or you might get a scholar or something like that. So it was a neat, way to get a few extra resources in just one more place where the economy felt a little more open.
Another resource I want to bring up, they have these scholars in this game that Chris just mentioned that don't exist. There's nothing akin to them in Gaia Project. So I don't know about those. Those were okay. You're kind of sending them out to these little tracks if you want to get rid of them, and they'll help you move up the tracks. And you can use them for a couple other things, but I don't know about the scholars. I'm not too sold on those dudes.
It's a little weird.
Yeah. One more resource to manage it for just a couple of unique places. On the other hand, the books, which, you know, kind of replaced the QIC cubes from Gaia Project, they were kind of neat because you could turn them in for these like round benefits that QIC cubes have, but these are variable per, you know, every game is going to be set up different, or you could turn a bunch of them in for one of these big innovation tiles. So it's slightly little differences between these games. Let's talk about the theme and production here. You know, we always mention when we get to play a game in person versus on Board Game Arena, this was on Tabletop Simulator, and this was a mod that some user had put up there, and it was clear that they weren't using finished production components across the board. So my iconography wasn't quite right. Some of the artwork appears to have changed a little bit when we look at the rule book. Not sure where they got those from. So, you know, I'm just going to be a little hesitant to say too much about the iconography or the artwork. What I can say from looking at the finished components in the rule book and what I've seen online is that overall the look and feel of this feels outdated to me. And probably my biggest complaint about the game as a whole, it feels like it was made 10 years ago. The only artwork that really stood out was the artwork on the civilization cards, which was pretty cool, which was pretty nice. But everything else, like look at the science tracks. There are these pillars with, you know, numbers printed on them, gold bordering around the edge. It looks like I played Firenze, which is like a 20-year-old game, the other day, and it looked almost like the exact same game board. And across the board, that's what I felt like. All of the symbols, all the little cards had these little, you know, old-fashioned picture frame borders on them and stuff like that. To me, it felt outdated.
I don't even know what to say.
You could disagree with me, Chris, and move on.
No. Words fail me. Now, I can't believe that you defend the goofy cartoon artwork in Gaia Project and yet are going to bust on Age of Innovation. Yes, that is true. There is no monkey in a spacesuit in this one. So it's, you know, maybe that's a downside. Now, I'm kind of being sassy about it, but in this game, I thought I thought it looked fine. I thought it was a decent looking game. Like you said, we didn't see the final art in a lot of it, but I think, you know, I've seen enough of it online and in the rule book, and I like the way it looks. It's perfectly functional. It's kind of like Gaia Project. Everything that I see is fine, gets the job done, but it's not the most exciting, especially with the iconography. I didn't like the overcomplexity of the iconography. But other than that, I thought the art was decent.
I'm with Tim on this one a little bit, and with Chris on this one a little bit. I think it is very throwbacky, and you have these wooden components, which I think is nice compared to the plasticky earth harming components in Gaia Project. You've got these wooden throwback components, and you got your tradition. I don't know if it's a traditional meeple shape. I hope not. It looks like it's a little more thinner than your chunky, waddly, meeple shape character for the scholar people, which is nice for me. But the board itself, I think, is beautiful. It has these vibrant hexagons, easily distinguishable from one another. You're in this setting, this kind of pastoral setting on some cliffy, rivery network of islands. I think the colors are great. They pop out. Iconography, yeah, it's a little old school, but you'll recognize it if you've played any of this series of games before. I don't know. It's not bad, but it is definitely throwbacky. I think the player boards, the art on there, I give this a thumbs up over the player boards of Gaia Project for sure. So that's where I'm definitely with Chris. The art is way better. You got the goblins that look creepy and fantastic. Tim has some beef with those guys. I don't know what's up with that. But I really appreciate the player artwork. Got me into the game a lot more than did other artworks in other games.
Well, I definitely like the monkey in a spacesuit over those goblins, but the rest of the artwork was fine on those player boards. The player boards themselves actually had a pretty good user interface. You know, like there's a lot of stuff going on that you're looking at, and I thought it represented pretty well. And then you're right, the board itself looked nice too. It's just more that there's so many of these tiles, you know, and that sideboard. The sideboards are just, I don't know. This definitely, like, it turned me off. I was excited about this game because I love Gaia Project, because I wanted to see what they were doing as a next version of it. And then I looked at the components and the artwork and I was like, I'm not that excited anymore. I'm glad I played it, but, you know, I think they could have done better for a game that is such a hallmark series. Just because Gaia Project wasn't great doesn't mean they couldn't have put a beautiful new production on this, and it doesn't feel like a beautiful new production to me.
So what are you talking about specifically? What would you like to see different as far as, was it components or just the sideboards, or how they, you know, they have these old school framey kind of things and the wreaths around the points and stuff?
Yeah, that's the type of stuff. Yeah, it's the frames on the tiles, and it's the sideboards. Just everything just looked a little bit old school, a little mediocre to me.
Yeah,
that's my perspective. Other than that, I don't really have any comments on the production. This game isn't, I'm not buying it for the production. I am buying it because it's chock full of cool mechanisms and amazing gameplay. You know, and so it would have been nice if it had a little bit more modern, I don't know, updated flair to it. So many great artists that could have put some cool style on this game board. What would Ian O'Toole have done with this? This would have looked amazing, right? I mean, just picture that.
WWIOTD, whatever. Anyway, here's a hot take for you. My beef with this game is not the production. It's thematic.
I'm interested.
Okay, you ready for this?
Okay.
All right. So terraforming made sense to me in Gaia Project, because if I'm a human and I go to another planet, it makes perfect sense that I can only live in a place that's able to sustain human life. In this game, I was the navigators. And I can get that maybe we prefer water, we prefer lakes and wetlands and things like that because, you know, we're boat people. But why are we incapable of living anywhere else? I don't get that part. It doesn't make any sense to me. I'm really kind of joking. I mean, that is an oddity. It doesn't make any sense to me. That's kind of ridiculous. But I get what they were doing. I actually thought the game was charmingly themed. It's, you know, the fantasy version of Gaia Project, more or less, kind of like Terra Mystica. So it's not really a beef. That doesn't really bother me, but it is one of those things that I found myself being pulled out of the game just slightly, because I was going, but why can't I build a house on dry land? Why do I have to build my house on a lake? Anyway, that's my problem.
I think it's a fair point. Yeah, sand dunes next to wetlands, next to mountains, all within a 3-mile radius of each other.
All right. Well, let's ask the final question, and that is, would you request to play Age of Innovation again?
I would request to play it again. I had a lot of fun playing it. If this gets an implementation on Board Game Arena, it might eventually replace Gaia Project for us. And we go to that game, I don't know, once a month, more or less. Maybe more often. But I enjoyed it. There's a lot to explore here. Like you said earlier, Tim, I had a lot of fun playing it. It looks like there is a lot of stuff if you're going to set this thing up in person. So I don't know. I'm interested to hear what you're going to say. Is this going to replace Gaia Project for you, Tim? That's a curiosity, and that's something I want to hear.
Yeah, well, I really liked it. I really liked it. And I think if I didn't own Gaia Project and I was going to buy one of these two, honestly, I'd probably buy Age of Innovation. Right now, it feels like there's going to be just more to explore in this game. But I like Gaia Project, and it's not drastically different enough where I would say, time to throw out Gaia Project and get this. However, at some point, if I see this on sale, it's very likely I'll pick it up. And then if Gaia Project doesn't get played for a couple of years, because this is all that's getting played, maybe it will eventually replace Gaia Project. That said, I definitely will be asking to play this anytime I can. Gaia Project was my number two game last year, and I think I like this a little bit more. So you got to imagine that this is pretty high on my list. And I think you can expect me to be mentioning this in our next top 40 list. Hopefully I get a chance to play it some more before then. But if nothing else, it may be one of those situations where I'm always saying like, hey, Gaia Project and Age of Innovation, yeah, they're my number two game, right? Because yeah, they are so close in so many ways. And I would play either of them anytime. So absolutely loved, you know, this experience with Age of Innovation. I had played Terra Mystica once before, and Gaia Project always felt like an evolution for me. And this definitely felt like an evolution of a Terra Mystica. So over Terra Mystica, I would pick this 100%. It's theme very similar, and I think only improves everything with Terra Mystica. You know, Gaia Project, I think, has some major differences that are positive, but not necessarily critically positive here. So I don't know. I don't even know what to say other than it was an awesome game. You should play it if you like a heavy game.
I definitely would ask to play this one again. I also really enjoyed this. And like you guys, Gaia Project is already one of my top games. So this one was kind of a no-brainer. But where I have a little bit more trouble is whether I like this one more than Gaia Project. Because honestly, there are things that I like better in Gaia Project, and there are things that I like better in Age of Innovation. So it wasn't a straight evolution where, you know, everything that they was done differently in Age of Innovation was better. I still like the technology tracks better in Gaia Project. I like having that kind of progression where every step you move up the track, you get some kind of a bigger benefit. You know, like, you know, you can move two steps if, you know, two planets away if you are at this level, four planets at that level. You know, you get this much income if you're at this level, this much income if you're at that level. You know, I like that kind of a progression. And that actually, I think, is really nice. And I thought that Age of Innovation, while it added a lot of variability, I didn't like the actual effects as much. So I'm just using that as an example of one thing where I actually think Gaia Project was a little better. I also mentioned before that the tightness of the economy in Gaia Project turns me off a little bit. The looseness of the economy in Age of Innovation is better. So I don't know. I actually feel like I would have to go back and play at least a couple of games of this one before I could make, you know, an informed decision about which one I think is the better game. But I definitely can see where, especially if you're a frequent player, having a game like Age of Innovation that has more of that variability is going to keep the game fresher. And if you don't mind the things that I was talking about as my relatively minor complaints, then that might be the right choice for you. But I feel like I have to play it a couple more times to tell.
All right, that will wrap up our conversation on Age of Innovation. We'll be talking about some games that have been on our table right after this. All right, welcome back. What have you guys been playing lately?
Well, Tim, I had a gaming buddy come over on Sunday, and it was you. And we played Trekking Through History, a game that Chris bought me for my birthday. So I hadn't played this before, and I was excited to get it out because I wasn't sure how much time we had, and I figured it was relatively light and easy to get through. So I had it set up when he got here, and we started playing this game. And this game is really neat. If you're familiar with any of the trekking through whatever, there's trekking through the national parks, which is supposed to be great. There's Trekking the World, which I own, and I absolutely love that game. And it's also on Board Game Arena. If you haven't tried it, give it a shot. The production for all these games is fantastic, including this one. There's a nice neoprene mat that comes with this one. There's big old cards that have beautiful scenes throughout history in this game, and they have a little explanation on the back telling you a little bit about the background of this game. The theme of this game is that you are buying a tour through this company that takes you on time travel tours. So what you're trying to do, you're trying to collect these cards. You get a little bonus for doing them chronologically. And whenever you pick them up, you get these little tokens that you're putting on your agenda. And as you're putting these tokens on your agenda, depending on how you fill them in, they give you little point bonuses or crystal bonuses. And there's also this another sideboard is a clock. This is the order you're going to go in. Each card costs like 3 hours or something like that. So you move your little clock three spaces, your little pocket watch three spaces around the big clock. Then you can spin these little time crystals to gain an hour back. So maybe that gives you two turns in a row. So a whole bunch of neat little easy to understand mechanisms for a relatively lightweight game. That's a lot of fun. Came together quickly. Tim and I breezed through this one, had a lot of fun playing it. Trekking through history, I thought it was pretty fantastic. What do you think, Tim?
I really like this game. This is a light little, I wouldn't even call it an engine builder, really. It's kind of order fulfillment, because basically each of the 3 days that you're playing through here, you all start with this unique card that kind of is asking for certain, I don't know what they're, elements or sciences or something like that. There's these different colored tokens. So you're trying to collect them, but the way you collect them is really simple. It's basically you're just drafting from a row of cards. And so you're going to basically just take a card out of the row. You get whatever benefits on there, and you get the benefit underneath that card. So that could be one of the reasons why you pick the card. But there is, as Adam mentioned, there's a time amount on it. So, you know, you want to be careful about taking cards that have really long times, because you're going to get less turns in the round with it. Really simple gameplay. I mean, that was about all there was to it. But surprisingly, there was some pretty good tension. The cards you were picking, it was a tougher choice than you would think. Trying to fill up those rows and thinking what other cards might come up to help you get that filled up. But also, when you're going through these time travel, you're trying to pick from the oldest date going forward. And there are dates in there that are like, you know, 300,000 BCE all the way up until like 1998. So, you know, you've got a very large range. So you're trying to make choices early in your round, or, you know, early in the sets that you're getting those earlier dates. But sometimes it's just the perfect combination of elements that you want to pick up on this card. So you end up picking up one later, kind of pushing your luck, hoping that a couple more later cards are going to come up. So for what is a simple mechanism, really good tension in the choices here. And my favorite part about it is that the artwork on these are great. They look like kind of old travel posters, but it's representing all kinds of different elements through time. Just beautifully done. Just has the date on the top. And then it will say something like, instead of just saying what the event was, it's kind of telling you to experience, like, break the sound barrier with Chuck Yeager, or share a dream with Martin Luther King Jr. So it was kind of putting you as an individual into the role of what you're doing on this card. And then if you flip the card over, it actually gives you some historical context for that event. And that was fantastic. In fact, you know, many of these events I was obviously know and was aware of, but there were some things in there, some historical events or people that I either had just a very tiny understanding that they even existed or didn't know at all. And I learned sitting down playing this fun little light game with Adam, I learned some things about people that I didn't know existed in history. So it was really just a great experience. I would not sleep on this game. I think check it out. If you're looking for like a great family weight game, you know, it's fun. I would go back to it in a second. I'm so glad Adam pulled it out for me.
That's so cool. And what a neat addition to the franchise. I love the idea of time travel. So the real question is this going to replace Anachrony for you?
They could sit side by side on my shelf with Anachrony. They would complement each other nicely.
A couple more of the cards I want to talk about before we move on. They have Place Senate with the Egyptians. So the little board game being referenced in a board game. How cool is that? That's 2686 BCE. Then you have Rock Out at Live Aid, 1985. This iconic scene of Freddie Mercury wailing away. You've got Tour Tesla's Lab at 1891 with a little electricity going on in the background. I think he's playing like Barrage or something in that one. Learn the Art of War from Sun Tzu, 506. BCE, so just some very cool cards. That's just a small sampling of what is in this game. I think there's something like 150 cards or so in this deck of cool moments that, like Tim was saying, half of them I didn't even know about. So it was fun to learn about these things as you're playing the game. Beautiful artwork here too, just like the other games in the series.
Yeah, and I don't think Adam mentioned the designer was Charlie Bink and the publisher is Underdog Games. And because I love the art so much, I do want to mention the artist as well. We should do this more often. It's Eric Hibbler. But really fantastic production, great design, great family weight game. I'd recommend it. All right, the game that's been on my table lately is I finally got around to trying Marvel Champions. This is by Fantasy Flight Games. The designers are Michael Boggs, Nate French, and Caleb Grace. But this is in one of their living card game lines where essentially you can buy a starter set and it gives you, in this case, it gives you a couple hero packs you can play with and some villain scenarios to play against. But the idea being that you can basically adapt your deck a little bit. So you can just play with what's right there out of the box, but you can buy expansions that will not only come with different characters to play, but also some extra cards that you can kind of, what you essentially do is you take your card, your character's deck, and you mix it with an attribute deck, like maybe honor or speed or something like that. And so then that's going to mix up how the, that character plays. What you're doing with this game is you're starting the turn with, you know, a hand of five cards, and the cards all have different abilities on them. They could either be a one-time effect or they can be something that goes into a little tableau that you can activate later, but they also have a cost, and the cost is going to make you discard other cards to play it. So it's pretty tight about like what you can do in a turn. Maybe you're only getting one or two cards played. And your character, this is one of the interesting things about it, is your character is two-sided. On one side, it's the alter ego. That's how you start. And the alter ego can't be attacked. It's just ignored by the villain. So when you got your alter ego out on the villain's turn, they instead work on their scheme, which is kind of a push in the end game by doing some dastardly deeds. But when you flip the card over, then it's your hero, right? And they've got their suit on and everything. So like Peter Parker turns into Spider-Man, and you can choose on your turn whether you end as the alter ego or the hero. So it gives you some fun choices there, and the way your cards may interact differently depending on whether your hero's up or whatever. And then the villains, essentially, they have a card, usually a couple of them. So once you defeat the first level, then you move to the next card in the series. Kind of like Cthulhu Death May Die handles their the great old one cards. But those essentially have, you know, an attack power, but they have the scheme deck. So what's going to happen every time is you're going to flip over a card at the end of your turn, and it's going to tell you what the villain does, whether it puts out minions that are going to, that you have to deal with, whether it's going to, you know, do, I mean, they do some pretty bad stuff. So the whole game is pretty heavy threat mitigation, where it's just like constantly things are happening that you have to deal with. But at the same time, eventually you have to try to eliminate the villain's scheme, stop them from doing their scheme, and knock the villain out. This game is, it was pretty fun. I played it now twice, once two player. So it's a multi, it's a co-op game if you play it multiplayer. So I played it multiplayer, and then I played it solo. I liked it more solo because I'm not a big fan of cooperative. I didn't think that cooperative added anything for me. I don't want to talk through my game decisions with somebody else, although I did lose when I played solo and won when cooperative. So probably just my bad strategy there. But it also, you know, the other person taking their turn and thinking through everything is just, it doesn't do anything for me in this game. So it was more fun to play solo. But it was interesting to see a variety of different characters, how the characters interact, how the villains interact. This is a pretty solid game. If you're a fan of the Marvel, you know, franchise, I mean, this is a, it's kind of a no brainer if you want a solo or co-op game. It's setups easy. It's fun. You can buy just the base game, and it comes with like four heroes that you can swap in and out, and like a couple different villains. But then they sell tons of different villains and hero packs and everything you can buy with it. I bought this used, and it came with four additional characters, hero characters, and like one villain scenario pack. My guess is this will be more than enough content. I'll never play this enough to need to buy more expansions or anything. But I did enjoy it, honestly, more than I thought I was going to. And it is a game that I plan to go back to and at least play several more times solo.
So, Tim, I'm kind of reluctant to say this, but it sounds conceptually not that different than Marvel United. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, it's completely different. But I mean, you know, from the fact that it's a threat mitigation game, kind of like a pandemic, it's that it's the same kind of game state as that. The difference is that the decks here, what the cards do, are significantly more interesting and complex than what Marvel United did. So that's really the biggest thing, which I was afraid of when I heard about this game. I thought, okay, this is going to be you either attack or you defend, and that's about it. But no, there's a lot of cards here that do some pretty significant engine building. You can build up this tableau with a bunch of abilities to activate. It's definitely a lot more interesting, both in what the heroes do and what the villains do, than Marvel United for me.
Cool.
Tim, are you going to buy any more decks, any expansions for this, or what's the next steps for you in Marvel Champions?
Yeah, I mean, probably not. If I do, it's only because there's one or two like cool characters that I'd like to try. But but probably not. Not that it's not deserving. If you get enough play out of this, and it'd be fun to explore more of it. But like I said, I've got like 8 characters to play here, and maybe I'll get through those in 2 years, you know, with how much I kind of replay games, especially solo games. If I had more time to play solo, that might be a different matter. But I could see, like, I happened to be at the store the other day before I got this game, and I saw that there's a new, like, Venom villain pack or hero pack. And I thought Venom was always one of my favorite characters. So I was like, wow, that'd be a cool character to play. So I could see myself being in a game store and for $12, you know, okay, I can just add this one hero that looks really cool. Maybe that'll happen. I'd say unlikely. I'm not going to be a collector of this. I'm not going to go all in and, you know, try to find every hero that I can find. So yeah, not too much deeper for me, but again, I think it's worth a visit if you like Marvel. If you don't, just stay away from it. It's just chock full of Marvel. So that's all you're going to get here is Marvel.
Well, on my table, both real and virtual recently, is a game that is a bit of a pleasant surprise to me. And that's Heat, Pedal to the Metal, which you guys will recall we did our review of along with Downforce quite a while ago. And then last week I had mentioned it on our Climax episode. And I think I mentioned then that I had played this for a second time at a recent game weekend. And during our review episode, I was kind of lukewarm on it, felt better about it after playing it live at the game weekend. And now since then, we've played a couple games on BGA, and this game is shifting into high gear for me. It is definitely moving up on my list. I'm enjoying it more and more every time I play it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that once you get this game down, you fly through it. It's such a simple game with such elegant mechanics from a thematic standpoint. I mean, the fact that you're using your little gear shifter to determine, you know, how many cards you're going to be playing, things like that, that are just so neat and so enjoyable. We play a lot of games on BGA, and right now, when Heat comes up, that's the one I'm looking forward to having my turn more than any other game. And I'm really happy that this game has turned out the way it did, because, you know, I could see the enjoyment in it when we played it, but it just didn't kind of hit me in my heart because it felt a little bit too heavy. Now the heaviness seems like it's gone, and I'm just able to enjoy this game for what it is, which is a brisk, fun racing game. I am loving Heat, Pedal to the Metal.
Yeah, Chris, I'm starting to come around to your side. When we played this for the review, I thought it just dragged on and on and on. But after playing on Board Game Arena, it flew through. I got to see the mechanisms come through a little bit. The quickness of this game is coming through. Trying to hit that, what's that called? So you can draft all the guys, slipstream, and move up a couple of spaces. That's pretty exciting. And then you got these turns coming up. You're going to navigate those. You're going to spin the Heat to get past that threshold so you can boom it down the straightaway and throw your 5 and your 2 4s out there and just cruise ahead. I'm having a lot more fun playing this one than I did on that first play. Tim is ready to poop all over this one.
No, not at all. I shouldn't even comment on it because you guys invited me on Board Game Arena. We've played a couple times now, but I've just kind of forgotten how some of the simplest rules work, and I haven't gone back and read the rule book, so I kind of don't know what's going on. I spun out, I think, 8 turns in the last game we played because I'm just, you know, it comes to my turn, I'm like, okay, I'll click these couple cards and play them. So no, I'm not, I don't want to say anything negative about it at all because I can't judge my recent experience on it. Glad you guys are having fun. I just have to spend 5 minutes, relearn it, and then I'll sit down and try a real game with it again. I suspect it's going to feel the same way that Flamme Rouge did and that Heat did for me the first time, which is that you do a whole bunch of stuff and then, you know, it doesn't matter a whole lot till the last couple turns of the game. That's fine. It could still be fun turns, but, you know, I'll give it another try once I learn it again.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, before we wrap up this episode, instead of reading a review from Apple Podcasts, which we often do, we had some really nice statements come up on our Facebook group. And I thought this was a good time to give some recognition to our friends over on our Facebook group. Now, when we started the show, I created a Facebook group, but I hate Facebook. I hate using it. And so I never posted anything there. And then about a year ago, when I realized that Twitter was probably not a platform that we wanted to keep being heavily involved with, I started looking at what else could we do. And so I went back to our Facebook group. And as I started talking about it, people started coming in pretty quickly. I think there's still a heavy user base on Facebook. And right now we have just under 300 community members on there. And again, this is not our Facebook page. It's the group. Okay. So if you're on Facebook, go to groups, find Board Game Hot Takes. This has been a fantastic group of people to hang out and chat with. So I just wanted to mention this week and call out a couple of nice things that some people said. First of all, it's not just about what we're posting. This is a community. Anyone can post there. And we're getting some great topics coming up. This week, here's some of the topics that came up just this week alone. Riley posted about games you got because of Board Game Hot Takes. 48 people responded to that thread, and it was so fun to read some of those answers. Matt shared a pic of his new baby, but also a list of his 3x3 challenge that him and his wife were still able to complete in the first month after his baby was born.
Nice.
Brian posted a topic about what was the best upgrade paths for cards in Ark Nova, which was super fun to me because I have a clear path and I was like, oh, this game is solved. And everybody had a different thought about which card you should upgrade first and in which order in Ark Nova. So that was a great conversation. Sean posted a question about which games he should try to bring to his work time lunch rotation. Got a ton of comments from people on that. A bunch of people posted just pics of their gameplays this week, which was great. We got to see pics of Botoku, Nucleum, Teotihuacan, Terraforming Mars. I mean, this is just, it's fun. These are great conversations that are happening, great people out there. I want to call out two people that kind of left us what I would call reviews on there, and it was just wonderful to hear these. So the first was Joanna, who you've heard us mention a couple times in poll results and stuff. She said, so I listen to you guys on Spotify, and I've been trying out other podcasts on board games as well. Some of the ones I'm trying are highly rated, winning Golden Geek Awards, and are clearly much bigger than you guys and are sponsored. None of them compare to you guys. You guys honestly are more professional, have better quality audio, stick to the format of your show, but still have funny banter. I appreciate the lack of swearing, and you're just so much better than some pretty highly ranked BG podcasts out there. And honestly, I like you're not sponsored or get review copies because then you can be truly honest, and I feel like I'm listening to people just like me. I'll keep trying others, but you guys really are still the best. Thanks for all the great content. You make driving to and from work and working out a delight. So nice to hear, Joanna. Thank you. I think this is the same Joanna that has been on Twitter with us for a while. But if it is, or even if it hasn't, it's great to have Joanna on our Facebook group. And just wonderful to hear those things and that you're not bored with us after all this time. So we had another person comment that I'll read this one and we'll wrap up for today. This was John Walmsley. He said, just joined the group, been listening to the podcast for around 6 months via Apple, picking up earlier episodes for games that interest me. Found BGA from the podcast too and enjoying that. Came across BGH TV at Twitter and happy to now connect here on Facebook from the UK. Took me a couple episodes to figure out which voice was Tim, Adam, and Chris. All sounded American to me at first. Enjoyed the top 40 games of 2023. Turned out to be 80 unique games. Yes, I counted it and excelled them. And I've since tried a few on BGA, which I've enjoyed, and hope to receive one or two games at Christmas. Thank you for putting out a high quality, informative, engaging, friendly podcast that sticks to the topic and doesn't add any bloat. But please bring back the cocktails from the earlier episodes.
Thank you for that, John.
John, yeah, I told Chris, I told him on there that I would definitely make sure you heard that comment. I also told him that you've been a bit busy to do the research and write up the cocktail segment, but anyway, thought you'd appreciate hearing that. John, this was super nice to hear. And I you know, after John commented on that, another member posted and said that he also excelled our top 40 list and made lists. And then they were comparing about how much statistics they ran on him. So I asked John to post it on our Facebook group, and he did. He posted his Excel sheet that shows all of our top 40 list, who basically ranked the highest overall, who ranked the most games similarly or both, you know, all had him on the top 40, which not surprisingly, Adam was the outlier. He shared less games with both of us. But it's just super fun and interesting analysis that somebody spent the time doing on our silly little podcast here. So John, thank you. Joanna, thank you. Everyone on our Facebook group, thank you. And if you're not on there and, you know, you care about Facebook or are on there at all, come join us. If you're not, I don't blame you. Stay away. Facebook still sucks, but our group is awesome on there. It's great. It's great to have this group out there. All right. Well, that will wrap up this episode. Thank you everyone for sticking around through our age of innovation. Until next week, take care.
Good night, all.
Bye-bye.